Welcome to Lecture 6 of Exploration, and if my memory serves, Mike is here with us for an hour, so this is going to be a jam-packed hour of fun, and we're going to learn about binary and subnetting and all sorts of good stuff, and we're also going to play with BC and a few other things. Now, before I get started, does anybody have any questions on things that aren't binary and subnetting before we get back into this binary and subnetting stuff?
I have a TerraTerm question, but I can put it off till after Mike has to leave. It's not urgent at all.
Well, no, he might find it useful, but if you want to know, if you're asking is it broken under JAWS 13, yes. But if you have a different question, feel free to ask me.
Well, you may have inadvertently just answered it. I couldn't get it to work, but I also can't find the file that has the settings in it. So I was trying to, through trial and error, change the cursor shape and the lines in the terminal, and I couldn't get it to work. But I also was using JAWS 13, so maybe all of the above is a factor.
Try launching NVDA. It'll probably be much better with that, and you don't even need to bother with the JAWS script. You do need to bother with the cursor shape, which is under Window, I think. Hang on. Opens a copy of TerraTerm. Oh, here's one we prepared earlier. Hit cancel on the connect dialog, Alt S, Window, and it's the second option. The first one is TerraTerm, the second one is cursor shape, and you can set it to vertical line or horizontal line, so that's where that one lives. And that will make a difference whether you're running NVDA or JAWS. But we don't know why JAWS 13 is broken with TerraTerm at the moment. It's sort of one of those things that I was going to report to Freedom Scientific, but I get the feeling that their response will be, we don't care.
And 24 lines, you know, right? That's the other thing I have to change.
That's very weird, because it doesn't seem to be broken on my JAWS 13. I can read the current line, and I can use a review cursor to read back through. The script doesn't seem to do much that's of interest, but that's about all.
Ah, you see, this is where you're missing out. The script reads everything that turns up on the terminal automatically. So if you were running the script under JAWS 12, as soon as text came on the screen, it would read automatically, and you wouldn't have to use the review cursor as much. But you are correct, you can pull the stuff off the screen with the JAWS cursor, which I find a little more time-consuming than having it automatically talk to me.
Yeah, it's a little more time-consuming, but using a pager, it's relatively painless. At least it works to develop whatever needs to be done. So that's not a huge showstopper for me in using TerraTerm.
Okay, so if you don't want it to read it automatically, which I do and most of my friends do, JAWS 13, we don't know why that doesn't work. I will try submit a bug report. Unfortunately, the author of the TerraTerm scripts is also the author of NVDA, so I don't think I'll see much help there. So we'll have a chase around and have a look. If you've got too much money, which I don't at the moment, you can also get a thing called CRT, which is about $100, so it's really expensive, which is why I don't usually recommend it, but it works awesomely well with JAWS, and they actually have accessibility in their product, and it does work very well. However, I don't necessarily recommend you getting that going. Your other option is Cygwin's SSH, which isn't so cool, but it's sort of all right. PuTTY works with NVDA, but I haven't seen it work well with JAWS, so that's an on-advisement thing. So, yeah, indirectly, Steve, that should answer your question. You either want to try JAWS 12 with the script and see if things get lots better. Change that cursor shape under Window, and then, no, under Window. And then the actual lines and columns are under Window. So if you think it's the size of the window, how much is that text in the window? That is where lines and columns are, and then the terminal thing's got the cursor shape.
And it's 80 by 24, right, is the correct column sizing?
That will definitely work. I have succeeded in getting it bigger. I've managed to get 80 by 35, but it depends on what res your screen's running in, as to how much text can actually fit on there and whether JAWS decides to be happy about it. Don't maximize TeraTerm. Bad things, TM, happen. Awesome. And if you're not reading the chat, there is a fix to TeraTerm scripts that Monica's looking at and talking to her contacts. There might be something very simple that we need to do for JAWS 13, and that will make a lot of us very happy.
Great, thanks.
With your permission, once I'm sure it's stable and actually is working, I will send it to you and we could put it in extras if that's all right with you.
We certainly can. I should probably also point out to you at the moment that you also already have right permission into extras, and whilst it's probably safer to send to me to put there, you can actually win SCP it yourself, if I'm not available. Alrighty, let's talk about binary, let's talk about borrowing bits, which sounds a bit odd, but it's something. Yeah, that's probably a good idea, actually. Take, pull it from the termnotes.txt under extras. There's a... hang on. No, it's under general instructions networking. There's a TeraTerm tutorial there that if you pull from there, there's a whole lot of text that's already there, and then you can do some article spinning. No, I'm just kidding. You can edit it up a bit and stick it in the wiki.
Perfect. That's the document I couldn't find, so now I know where that is, and I will do it.
Oh, sorry about that. I think you came in late, and... like, I don't think you were at the first lecture because you only got convinced to do it afterwards, and I did mention that in the first lecture and I never mentioned it again. So for the recording and for anybody else, there is TeraTerm documentation under general instructions networking, and there's a little guide that tells you where all the settings are and what you need to set up. Julie, this is exploration. You're welcome to listen, but I'm just warning you that this is exploration. Alrighty. Okay, and obviously, if somebody wants to stick the TeraTerm document in the regular wiki as well, or link to it from the regular wiki into the Linux wiki, although it's probably... probably should go in the regular wiki. Feel free to grab... the text if Steve attacks it and transplant it into the other wiki. That would be awesome. And there are some paragraphs that I'll send whoever's working on it, or I'll edit in myself about things that Debbie's added into that documentation, some of which I agree with, some of which I don't agree with. And I'll be making sure I take out the bit that says, well, you just use Braille, because not all of us are that lucky. Or at least I wasn't that lucky up until 2007. Alrighty, let's get started on the binary. So, a couple of weeks ago we talked about counting systems. We talked about the fact that if you are working in base 10, you have a number of sets of different columns. You have 10 to the power of 0, which is 1. You have 10 to the power of 1, which is 10. You have 10 to the power of 2, which is 100. Some people thought that it should be called 10-ty, because, you know, there's 90 and then 10-ty, but that didn't happen. 10 to the power of 3 is 1,000, 10 to the power of 6 is 1,000,000, you get the idea. If we have the number 123, we have 1 lot of 10 to the power of 0 plus 2 lots of 10 to the power of 1 plus... 3 lots of power of the 0, 10 to the power of 0 plus 2 lots of 10 to the power of 1 plus 1 lot of 10 to the power of 2. Does anybody need me to go through any of that stuff again, or slow down on any of that?
No.
Nope.
Alrighty. Okay, now here's where it gets fun. It is optional if you wish to have a notepad document in front of you to scribble, because I'm going to talk, and you might want to write, but then you might want to listen. It's up to you. The point of base 2 is that... we use powers of 2 instead of powers of 10. The powers of 2 are 2 to the power of 0 is 1. And then each time you increment the power of 2, you get double the number of things. So if you've done cellular division in biology and stuff, and the way viruses and things replicate, 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128. Generally speaking, we will not be converting numbers larger than 255 from binary to decimal in this course. It is well worth the time taken to memorize the powers of 2, up to 2 to the power of 7. So 2 to the power of 7 is 128, 2 to the power of 6 is 64, 2 to the power of 5 is 32, 2 to the power of 4 is 16, 2 to the power of 3 is 8, 2 to the power of 2 is 4, 2 to the power of 1 is 2, and 2 to the power of 1 is 1. Did I put a table of those in the binary exercises? Because I probably should go back and jam one in if I haven't.
I don't recall it, but you went through them very thoroughly in the preamble to the binary exercise.
Alrighty, so the trick with binary is, as we said, a bit can either be set to a 0 or a 1, and if the bit is set to a 1, we have that power of 2 in our number, and if the bit is set to 0, then we don't have that power of 2 in the number. So basically your job is to find which permutation of ones and zeros is going to give you the right number of powers of 2 to add up to the number that you've got. So shall we be tedious and work through a couple of examples very quickly to make sure that you guys know how the conversion process works before I go on to borrowing bits and stuff. Alrighty. Now, does anybody remember the procedure for converting from decimal to binary?
Yes, you look for the largest power of 2 that will go into the target number without going over the target number.
Okay. And you subtract powers of 2 after that power of 2, and if you can subtract the power of 2, you put a 1, and if you can't subtract the power of 2, you put a 0. Is this ringing bells for everybody?
Ding dong.
Yeah, excellent. Pavlov will be very proud. Sorry, you had a question, Steve?
But if you can subtract a power of 2, wouldn't it have then meant that you should have added an extra power of 2 initially?
No. Let's assume we're converting the number 16 into binary, okay? So, what's the largest power of 2 you can subtract from 16?
8?
No, the largest power of 2 you can subtract from 16 is 16.
16.
Okay. So, if you subtract 16 from 16, you get nothing left over. So you put down a 1, and then you look at the next power of 2, you go, can I subtract 8? No, 0. Can I subtract 4? No, 0. Can I subtract 2? No, 0. Can I subtract 1? No, 0. So you end up with 1, 0, 0, 0, 0. And that is what 16 in binary is. And I'm quite happy to do a few more of those. The fact is that when you add all of the powers of 2 together again, it sounds like Humpty Dumpty. If you add all the power of 2s that you have actually picked out that are set to the 1 bits together, you should end up with a number that you started with. So, let's say, for example, we have binary 111, okay? So the right-hand digit says we've got a 2 to the power of 0, so we've got a 1. The next digit across says we've got a 2 to the power of 1, which is a 2. And the next one across says we've got a 2 to the power of 2, which says we've got a 5. So that means we have a 5 plus a 2 plus a 1. So 111 in binary is 7. Do I need to rehash that a bit more, Steve? Because you're You're a little bit quiet.
It's okay. Go ahead. Yeah.
You can always hit me up on Skype. Like, if you don't want to go through it here or whatever, you can always hit me up on Skype and ask me about it, and I'll be more than happy to sit down and work through it with you. And I'm sure some of the other people would be more than happy to work through it with you. So don't think we're not going to help you. We're not going to leave you out there to not understand this. But I'll do the borrowing bit stuff, and then we'll see how we're situated. And I'm quite happy to slow it all down and go back through it with you again.
Okay, thanks. No, I think, yeah, we'll do that at some point.
Look, binary is one of those things. I don't know. Does anybody remember learning how to tie their shoelaces? I used to be awful at tying my shoelaces. I remember when I was 5, I used to do all these bizarre knot things in the hope that I wouldn't trip over my laces. And then people would just like go, oh, gee, you've sure made a mess of that. And then they'd tie my laces for me. And then I'd be like, wow, that is such an awesome bow. And then by the time I was 6, I finally figured out how to tie my laces. And I'm just like, you know, this is really, really easy. I don't know why I had such trouble with that. But if you'd asked me when I was 5, tying my laces was out of the question. The point I'm making is that binary is like that. When you're initially trying to understand it, it seems an unachievable. Oh, look, as long as the grammar police don't knock down my door. It's not an easily achievable goal when you first get started, because it is a little bit alien. You're just like, why do these computers use this stupid number system? Why can't my computer just have 10 fingers like me? Well, it'd be a pretty odd looking computer, and that is not how electrical circuits work, generally speaking. It will fall into place eventually. And once you get the things together, it's just simple addition and subtraction. Well, I say that because I'm good at maths, but it's just addition and subtraction, and it's not like algebra or fractions or something nasty like that. So we'll all get there. But let's move on to talking about IP addresses and stuff. And we'll come back and if we need to go through more of that stuff later, we'll go and sort that out. Okie dokie, quiz question. Can anybody tell me how many bits long is an IP address?
32.
Okay, we have an answer from Mike. Do you understand why it is 32 bits long, Steve? Because I'm quite happy to explain it as well, because it's important.
Four blocks of 8?
Yeah, and would you believe each number in the IP address is a block of 8 bits?
I would.
Excellent. That will save me convincing you that the Tooth Fairy and the Easter Bunny are real. Okay, awesome. So, if we look at an IP address, say for example this one. Oh, no, I can't type there. Go in here. Let's do a really easy one. Okay, so we've got an IP address of 192.192.192.192. Okay. If we need to convert 192 into binary, okay, the way I do it is I open up a Notepad document, and I fully admit that I have a lot of practice doing this, and you can all hate me afterwards. Okay, 192, the biggest power that will come off 192 is 128. Does everybody agree with that? 2 to the power of 7 is 128. That's the biggest one we can subtract from 192.
Yep.
Alright, the next power of 2 that will come off, we take 192 and we take off 128, we're left with 64. The next power of 2 that will come, so I've just pressed 1 in my notepad window, by the way, just so that you guys know what I pressed. The next one, we take 128 from 192 and we end up with 64. So we know that we can subtract 64 off, so I press 1 again. Okay, so I've got 2 ones in here, and a braille display. Yay me. Alright. I now know I have nothing left. So I ask myself, can I subtract 32? No. Press the 0. Can I subtract 16? No. Press the 0. Can I subtract 8? No. Press the 0. Can I subtract 4? No. Press the 0. Can I subtract 2? No. Can we see a pattern here? Press the 0. Can I subtract 1? No. Press the 0. So the answer I have is 11000000. Now the trick with that method is that I just had to remember where I was up to. The only things I had to remember was the remainder I had and what I could take off it. And then all I had to do was just drop down the zeros and ones into the notepad document and deal with the mess once I'd finished. So that IP address turns into 11... that was really unpleasant.
Yes, all without the points.
Well, you can put the... It is possible to use dotted binary notation. You can put the decimal points in to separate the digits off. You could use dots, you could use spaces. Generally, you use spaces, but you can actually put dots in there to separate it off if I'm showing it to you. That's not technically correct, but if I put it in as one big long number, it will be much harder for you to understand what the synthesizer is spitting out. So what we did there was we converted each byte in the IP address, which was 192.192.192.192, and we converted those bytes to binary, and we made sure that each of the binary things that we converted was 8 bits wide. It's very important that there is 8 bits in each one of the four numbers. Now, if you don't have enough for 8 bits, like say you've got a number like 37, you've got to left-hand pad it with zeros to get the 8 bits, 8 bits, 8 bits, 8 bits. That is what we call dotted quad notation, and it means you've got four things separated by full stops. Any questions on that stuff? Who would have thunk that 192.168.whatever was so complicated? It's just one of those numbers that's in your router. But no, there are very good reasons why we do this way, and I will be showing why that is in just a moment. Alrighty. Now, one of the things you've got to understand about IP subnets is that when you create an IP subnet, there are two quantities that are important. The first one is the IP address, and the second one is the subnet mask. So has somebody seen something like this?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Yes, that's a
Class C mask.
Class C.
And let me tell you the easy way to remember this. If you're a Braille user, you're not a Braille user, are you, Mike?
No, sadly, one of the skills I never picked up.
Well, that's okay. It's just not going to make as much sense to you as it will to Steve, who is a Braille user. If you look at the Braille numbers, which have got number sign A, number sign B, number sign C, which gives you the numbers 1, 2, and 3, that also is how you remember class A, B, and C, and that's the number of 255. So it's like it's easy as A, B, C, 1, 2, 3. If there's 1, 255, and then 3 zeros, so 255, 0, 0, 0, that's a class A. But if there are three of them, that's 255.255.255.0. So it's as easy as A, B, C, 1, 2, 3. Okay, I'm just going to up my sensitivity a little bit because this is triggering a bit too much. Back in a sec. Okie dokie. So, class A is 255.0.0.0, class B is 255.255.0.0, and class C is 255.255.255.0, and you're all going to want to shoot me because we got rid of the class system, generally speaking, and now we use a thing called CIDR, which is classless interdomain routing, which I will talk about in a little while once we do all of the other stuff. So, if we look at... So if we look at the IP addresses that we had, so we got 192.168.1.45, netmask 255.255.255.0. The key thing you need to understand about the subnet mask, and this is desk thumping material here, the subnet mask tells you how many bits are in the network portion and how many bits are in the host portion of the IP address. So basically it says how many bits of the 32-bit number belong to the network portion of the address and how many bits belong to the host portion. Now, can anybody see how many bits are in the network portion and how many bits are in the host portion if we have a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0?
24 and 8.
Yeah, what do you think, Shah? Do you think yep. Steve, can you see that? Or is that a bit odd? 255 is 8 binary ones. So you've got 8 binary ones, 8
yep,
binary ones, 8 binary ones. Yep. Oh, good. Was that what you were going to say, Charlene? 8 and 4? 8 and... Blah, 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 3 and 1. Or 24 and 8? Okay, good stuff. Okay, so if we have a subnet mask of... Hey, let's do wrinkly bits here, okay? And this is going to take a little bit for everybody to work out. What if we had a subnet mask of 255.255.255.192? Ooh, yes, he's not very nice, is he? How many bits do we have in the network portion, and how many bits do we have in the host portion? I'll give people about 10 seconds more to think. If you're not thinking about your answer to this question, why don't you consider one of the other awesome courses that Kavi provides? IT Essentials, Introduction to Linux, and Discovery are all waiting for your study pleasure. Okay, so how many bits have we got in the network portion and how many bits have we got in the host portion? 255, 255, 255, 192. Okay, yes, Mike.
26 and 6.
Okay. Everybody else agree with that? Is anyone confused as to how we got that? Alright, so let's assume...
I think that's just because of my understanding of binary.
Okay, well, I'll very quickly summarise and say what he did was he converted the... 255, 255, 255 into binary, and he got 24 ones. He then converted the 192, which was the number we used earlier, to 11 and then 6 zeros, and that means he had 26 ones and 6 zeros. So that's how we got the answer, and I will quite happily work through that more slowly with you later.
Got it.
All right, let's do one more, just to make sure that we're really understanding how this works. What if I have a subnet mask of 255.255.255.224? How many bits do I have for the network, and how many bits do I have for the host? All right, Charlene's got an answer. Yes, I'd agree with that. Has anybody else got that answer?
Yep.
Now, I'll give you a shortcut here. If you actually take 256 minus 224, you actually get 32 left over. 2 to the power of what gives you 32? That gives you 5 bits. Therefore, you know you have 5 bits in the host portion, and then you can say 32 minus 5 is 27. That is an I've been doing this for too long shortcut. Alrighty, any questions on that? Alright, now let's take our network that we had earlier. We had 192.168.1.45, 255.255.255.0. Alrighty, so that is our network and our subnet mask. Did we all read in the notes somewhere that if on any IPv4 subnet, there are two reserved addresses. One of them is the network address, and the other is the broadcast address. The network address, it used to be different, but the network address is where all of the bits in the host portion are set to zero. So can anybody tell me what the network address of the 192.168.1.45 subnet is with a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0?
192.168.0.0.
Almost. 192.168.1.0. Because remember, there's only 8 bits in the host portion that you're setting to 0, so the 1 survives in the second octet.
More of regular computers got thrown by that, yeah.
Alrighty, so basically, if all of the host bits are set to 0, we're going to have 0 in the host portion, and that is going to be our network address. If we are going to create a route to that network, and I will cover routes next week. Oh, you're all looking forward to this, aren't you? You have to route to the 192.168.1.0 network with a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0. That is how we tell the router which network. And we might say that route is on interface 1 or interface 7 or whatever, and the router can then send the traffic sensibly to that destination set of IP addresses. So if you look at your home router, and on one side of it, it's got a wide area network interface, say cable or ADSL or wireless or whatever it's got. And then on the other side, on the LAN side, it's got 192.168.1.0 with a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0. Basically, when a packet comes into the router, and I don't want to complicate the issue too much here, but basically the router looks at the packets and it sees where they're destined. And if it's destined to something that isn't 192.168.1.0/255.255.255.0, it will send it out the cable, the ADSL, or the WAN interface. Does that make sense to anyone?
Yeah.
Now, the fact that it's going to do network address translation and stuff, I don't really want to talk about that at the moment, but essentially that is how the router figures out whether traffic is local to your subnet or whether it is remote. If the router can route directly to the destination IP address given the destination IP address and the subnet mask, it is local to the current network. If it cannot, it must either be handled by an entry in the routing table, or it must be sent via the... Can anybody tell me what it's got to be sent by? Everybody a bit mystified? If it can't be sent by a route in the routing table, it needs to be sent through the default gateway. The default gateway is the catch-all route where any traffic that cannot be handled by entries in the routing table is sent to. So if you have an integrated services router on your home network, okay, your 192.168.1.0 traffic, okay, you can play your Miley Ray Cyrus or your Lady Gaga, and you've got all your iTunes network sharing, and all of that works on 192.168.1.0. And yes, don't tell me that the Apple uses IPv6. I don't want to talk about that today because I'll just bend everybody's brain. Anything that is not destined to 192.168.1.0, any of the addresses between on that subnet, is sent through the default gateway. And can anybody tell me, where does the default gateway generally point to?
It points to the WAN.
It certainly does. It points to the wide area network. It points to the internet. So, when... This is more table thumping stuff. I didn't mean to do routes this week, but it kind of makes sense. When traffic is destined to something on the local network, it goes to the router either by wireless or whatever else, and the wireless sends it, the router of wireless thing sends it back out on to the local network segment. If the traffic is destined to the default gateway, it is sent out the WAN interface on the router. So all of... Okay, and the routing table only makes sense to the device it is configured on. Okay, this is underlines, this is underscores, this is write stuff across the sky. Yes, Charlene?
Sorry, I keep forgetting to lurk. So the default gateway, it always says, is 192.168.1.1. So why do we use that address to get into the router instead of 192.168.1.0? Or am I confused?
No, that's a very good question. You are slightly confused, but I'm going to unconfuse you. If you send a packet to 192.168.1.0, you send packets to the entire 192.168.1 network. Not any host on it, you send it to the network address of that network. If you send a packet to 192.168.1.1, that is the IP address of your router, not the IP address of the 192.168.1 network. Yes, Steve.
I saw a router at one point that had the network, or the IP addresses that were given out, were 192.168.1.x. However, the router address was 192.168.0.1. Wouldn't that technically then mean that the router was essentially routing to another subnet on which only itself was on?
Yes, and I don't know why that would have been configured like that. I'm just morbidly curious, and I don't usually ask people, is that noise in the background a radio repeater, or was that just one of your notifications?
Oh, that was a notification, I think.
Oh, no, it's okay. I was just morbidly curious. I thought maybe we've got more than one of us on here that plays with UHF repeaters. So the point is that when you look at network configuration, okay, the configuration of the internal PCs on this network, on our fictional network, the default gateway needs to point to the integrated services router. The default gateway of the internal machines on this network points to the integrated services router. And the gateway on the integrated services router points to the internet. Does anybody have a problem with this concept? It's all right, I'll take a chill pill in a second. I'm just very passionate about this. All of the internal machines have their gateways pointed at the integrated services router. The integrated services router, being the magic black box that it is, handles those packets and shovels them through to the internet. So the gateway of the integrated services router must be set to the internet, whereas the gateway of your workstations must be set to the integrated services router.
I got it.
What
so
happens?
The address the router uses to get to the internet. Oh, sorry.
No, it's okay. Yeah, the IP address that the router uses to get to the internet. Go ahead.
Is the one you get from your ISP, yes?
Yes. Yes, I believe she's got it, and it's not terminal. Okay, so here's a question. If we've got a simple home network, what is the first hop of any trace route going to be? Steve.
Assuming that we're running the trace route from a machine on the network, the first would be our local router.
Yes. And if we are running the trace route from the local router, the first hop will be the ISP. Is everybody cool with it? Okay. Now, the point is... the fact is that your router only needs enough knowledge to get to routers and devices that know more than it. So your little integrated services router knows about your local machines on your local network, and it knows about your internet service provider. If it can't handle packets that are destined to anything that isn't on your local network, okay, so I broke that sentence. If the packets it handles are not on your local network, the only choice it has to do is to forward it to the ISP. The ISP then knows more about it. But say, for example, you've got a little town ISP and it's got like a link to New York, and it's got another link to Los Angeles. I have no idea why. And depending on what IP addresses it sees, it will send some of them to New York and it will send some of them to Los Angeles. The ISP doesn't know any more than that. It just knows enough to say the packets go to Los Angeles or the packets go to New York. It's a bit like the mail routing system. When you post a letter, it looks at like the country, and then once you've got the country sorted out, the mail exchange in the country looks at the state or whatever, and then it looks at the city, and then it looks at the street, and then the postie looks up your street number. And this is what we call a hierarchical addressing scheme. Does anybody have any questions on that stuff so far? Does this make any more sense to people? Can people see how these routers sort of behave?
Could there be two gateways? Say, you wouldn't do this in a home network, but say you wanted, for redundancy sake or whatever, a second internet connection in case something were to happen to the first one. Could you have two gateways on a router?
You certainly could, and you can actually have two gateways on a workstation. There is another piece of information that is in the routing table which we call the metric, and it is a number between 1 and 255. The higher the metric, the more expensive the route. So say, for example, you have your little home router configured and it has one route to a cable connection with metric 1. It has another route to an ADSL connection with metric 10, and it has another route with a metric to a satellite connection, which is metric 30. So by default, all traffic is going to go to the cable connection. Then if the cable connection fails, it will go to the ADSL, and if the ADSL fails, it will go to the satellite. Does that make sense?
Perfect.
Alrighty, now, in the last 6 minutes, I'll try and stop Mike from banging his head against a wall, which apparently uses 150 calories an hour, but I still wouldn't recommend it. And I have no idea who came up with that statistic. If you are looking at breaking larger networks into smaller networks, instead of having network bits and host bits, you have three sorts of bits. You have network bits, subnetting bits, and host bits. So what happens is the networking bits show you the supernet that you're connected to. The subnetting bits show you how many subnets you can make. If you have one bit, you can make two subnets. If you have two bits, you can make four subnets. If you have three bits, you can make eight subnets. And this is what Cisco calls the borrowed bits, because you borrowed the bits from the host portion. And every time you borrow bits from the host portion, you can have less hosts. So let's work an example. If we have a subnet of 192.168.1.0, mask 255.255. Alright, so here we have 24 bits for the network portion and 8 bits for the host portion. Is everybody cool with that? Now, let's say I borrow 2 bits from the host portion of the network, okay? So now I've got network 24, subnet 2, host 6. Is everybody cool with that?
Yeah.
Alright. Now if I've got 6 bits for the host, given that the formula is 2 to the power of n minus 2 to figure out how many hosts we can have, how many hosts can I have on a 6-bit subnet? No, not 128. Anyone else? Charlene? Yes, 2 to the power of 6 is 64. Minus the 2 for the network address and the broadcast address, and I haven't covered the broadcast address yet, so I forgive you guys for not knowing about the broadcast address. We end up with 62 hosts on that subnet. I have borrowed 2 bits from the host portion. How many subnets can I make?
4.
Yes. If I have 2 bits, I have the combinations 00, 01, 10, and 11. So if I have 4 subnets of 64 IPs, how many IPs do I have altogether? Does anyone know what 4 times 64 is? 256. So 64 and 64 is 128, and 64 is 192, and another 64 is 256. How many IP addresses did I have on the original 192.168.1.0 network? This is not a trick question.
255.
No, I had 256. I had 256. This is including the reserved ones. 0 to 255 is 256 combinations. So what I did here was split the 256 addresses for this subnet into 4 lots of 64. I should point out that in the extra labs folder there's a subnetting example that's been written out by me. Have you taken a look at that, Mike? Because it makes a bit more sense than Cisco's documentation.
Yeah, I was working through it, but I thought it'd be useful to use it in conjunction with this lecture. It wasn't entirely clear the first time I read through it. It's the kind of thing that might need a couple of read-throughs to make it less opaque.
No, absolutely. And I'm sure everybody else here has benefited from the going through of this. And I think you're just about to have dinner, if everything's running on time.
Yeah, it's time for me to go before I get belted over the head with a rolling pin. So 73s, and thanks very much, Kerry, for the instruction this evening. I'll take the rest on the MP3 when it's put up on the FTP site.
No worries. Enjoy your dinner and try and dodge that rolling pin. Alrighty. Does anybody have any questions or queries? Did any of that make any sense to anyone? It's okay if it didn't. It doesn't have to the first week.
I think I understand conceptually what you're doing. Of course, I'm struggling to figure out how to come up with the numbers, but other than that, I understand, I think, how you're dividing it into the lots.
Yes, and the key to subnetting, and the reason... The reason that we make you all work this out in your heads is because you are not allowed to take a calculator into the exams. It's absolutely forbidden. You cannot take a calculator into the exams. You can get somebody to write things on bits of paper for you, and you still can't take a Perkins in. We're working on that. But the fact is that you have scratch paper and you cannot take in a calculator, which is why I'm so passionate about people doing the binary and stuff in their head. It's not because I'm nasty to you, it's because Cisco's nasty to you.
I have one quick question about the very last exercise, but we can cover that later if you want to, whatever.
No, we can do it here. I mean, we're all still sitting here and I can certainly answer it and stick it on the recording. What's your question?
So it's they want you to divide the subnet, and it's, I think if I remember right, 192.168.4.0 is the network address, and then they want you to divide it into 250, 20, and 90. Do you go up, because the .4.0 with the 250 machines takes up the whole all the bits for that, right? So do you go to 5 for the 20 and the 90?
Yes, you do. So what you have is 192.168.4.0 and a subnet mask of 255.255.255. 254.0, which means you have 23 bits for the host and you have 9 bits for the network. The network range goes from 192.168.4.0 through to 192.168.5.255. That is the range of the entire subnet. So you take the first subnet from 192.168.4.0, and you have a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0. You then take the next range. You can do it in either way, but the fact is that you have to break the boundaries on the biggest subnet boundary, which I haven't covered yet. So if you have the 90 hosts, you need a network of 128. So the range for that network is 192.168.5.1 to 192.168.5.127. And then you start the next network off at 128, 192.168.5.129 to 192.168.5.48, because you've got the 20 hosts. But you use the whole 32, actually. So you go from 5.128 to 5.159.
Okay, I did do the last one a bit wrong, but I think I did the other ones okay. I'll correct the last one and resend it.
Okay, I will check through that and make sure that's all good. But basically, when you are subnetting networks and you have variable length subnet mask, which is what we call this stuff, you've got to start the... You can't have a network of 64 and a network of 32 starting on... You've got to start the largest networks on a boundary of the size of the largest network. So a network of 64 has to start on something that's divisible by 64, and the network of 32 has to start on something that's divisible by 32, and the network of 128 has to start on something that's divisible by 128. And once you see how the bits fall, you'll see why that is the case eventually.